Welcome to Business and Oil. Articles from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Read by volunteers at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Legacy Reserves emerges from bankruptcy. Midland's Legacy Reserves emerged from bankruptcy protection last week, 6 months after voluntarily filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. After entering bankruptcy protection in June, the company had to undergo required filings, court hearings, and provisions. Dan Westcott, Legacy's chief executive officer, said in an interview, "The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the Southern District of Texas confirmed the company's reorganization plan last month. And since then, we've gotten all the documents drafted and approved," Westcott said. Legacy emerges from bankruptcy with significantly reduced debt outstanding, which was achieved by converting debt to equity, he said. Legacy now has $388 million of total debt outstanding, all of which is under a new reserve-based credit facility that has an initial borrowing base of $460 million. The company also has approximately $255 million of new equity capital. "We have a new board in place as well," Westcott said. The new board includes Westcott, Gary Gould, former chief operating officer of EQT Corporation, and former senior vice president production and resource development with Continental Resources, Richard Bentz, former chief executive officer and chief operating officer of Resolute Corporation, Robert W. Baker, former executive vice president and general counsel of El Paso Corporation, David Cope, former head of energy private equity of Caisse des Dépôts de Placement du Québec, Robert Horn, senior managing director and co-head of GSO's Energy Group, and Kyle Hammond, president and chief operating officer of Legacy. Westcott expressed his gratitude to the former board members, whom he described as incredibly diligent in their service and steadfast in their support. He also thanked the employees for their patience and dedication during the bankruptcy process. Legacy has the same assets and the same employees as it did before filing for bankruptcy protection, he said. And now that it has emerged, the company will continue to drill wells in the Permian Basin and operate those same assets, he said. "We're really gaining more freedom with great support from a new set of investors," Westcott said. "There wasn't a singular event or episode that pushed Legacy into bankruptcy," he said. "We were unable to extend our line of credit, so we are unable to pay our debts," he said. "We raised a lot of capital in 2014 when oil was $100 a barrel. Now that the company has significantly reduced debt and a new credit facility," he said, "it's an exciting time for Legacy. We are excited about the fresh start for Legacy and our impact on the community." ExxonMobil, A&M offer hazardous liquids training for first responders. With miles of pipelines, underground, and crude oil storage tanks dotting the Permian Basin landscape, knowing how to react in case of disaster is critical for area first responders. That's why ExxonMobil is teaming up with the Texas A&M Engineering Extension Service, TEEX, to provide a hazardous liquids emergency response training course for firefighters. A $200,000 grant from the oil giant funded the development of the course and participation of 100 firefighters at sessions in August and October. A third session is set for January 11th through 12th, and 50 firefighters have already signed up to participate. Nicholas Medina, Public and Government Affairs Manager for ExxonMobil Pipeline, is hoping to see firefighters from West Texas participate in the January session or additional sessions in 2020. Events such as pipeline ruptures or storage tank explosions are rare, but in the event they occur, preparedness is important, he said in a phone interview. The company's support of the course is part of its commitment to the communities where it operates, he said. In addition to the $200,000 grant that funded the development of the program, ExxonMobil will make another $200,000 grant for the program next year. municipal and volunteer firefighters do an awesome job at what they do. They are well trained for what they do, which is primarily house fires, car fires, rescues like that, said John Berg, director of the Industrial Firefighters Program at TEEX. But training for large plant fires such as Port Neches recently, or tank battery fires or pipeline fires, cost more than their budget allow, he said. The funding from ExxonMobil will allow municipal and volunteer firefighters to receive that training, he said. They pay for everything, hotel rooms, meals, the training, the fuel used in the training, that's very expensive. The foam used in the training, that's very expensive, Berg said in a phone interview. It is a win-win situation, he said. Not only do the communities where companies such as ExxonMobil, Dow, and Leondale Basil have plants, but pipelines and tank batteries have improved protection from better-trained firefighters, but those companies have additional support in case of fires or explosions. Those plants typically have brigades trained to combat the fires, he said, but those numbers are limited. That's why it's important to have backup from the municipal and volunteer firefighters. Your adrenaline is pumping, you're fighting fires, you're breathing air, you get worn out. It's important to have people that can rotate in and out, Berg said. The training is done at the 300-acre Brayton Fire Training Field. Berg said when the class arrives for a training session, it's like Disneyland. We have live fires in different scenarios. The fires are bigger than what they've ever seen. He cited the experience of the Hall DeZetta Fire Department in DeZetta, which participated in the first session in August. Fighting tank battery fires was one of the scenarios. 2 days after that session, Fire Chief Memo Gomez said they were called to a tank battery fire and knew how to respond. The training targets volunteer first responders because, as Medina explained, volunteers comprise 85% of the state's fire department. They are our first line of defense, he said. ExxonMobil's emergency response experts worked with TEEX to develop the pipeline and tank training curriculum. The training sessions are held at TEEX's Brayton Fire Training Field within the Emergency Preparedness Campus at Bryan College Station. Hello, this is Becky. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Sunday, December 15, 2019. This is the Oil Report. Drive to cut emissions will boost carbon capture, use, storage efforts. More than ever, energy companies are working to reduce their carbon dioxide and methane emissions and improve their environmental footprint. It's part of the industry's rising commitment to ESG, environmental, social, and governance, and sustainability policies. We try to do what makes sense, lower our emissions, and be more efficient, said Daryl Ricketson, Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of Kinder Morgan CO2 Company. Whether those efforts change the public's mind is a different question, he said. While in Midland last week to address the annual CO2 conference at the Barbara and George H.W. Bush Convention Center, Ricketson was addressing the first day of the conference, which was designated as a carbon management workshop. He said the company's Tall Cotton Field in Gaines County is the industry's first greenfield residual oil zone project. Tall cotton is a good potential resource that offers good pay, but processing rate and sweep challenges, he said. Optimizing future development of the field will require more data and better understanding of the field and its complex geology. Asked if Kinder Morgan is eyeing other ROZ fields, he said the company needs to study what it has before determining if there are other targets, and the oil price needs to be high enough to fund development. Developing tall cotton and other residual oil zones offers not only significant oil targets, but good potential for carbon capture, use, and storage, Ricketson said. The energy industry's growing commitment to environmental responsibility and sustainability will complement CCUS growth, he said. Technology and the ingenuity of people is needed to crack the code, he said. Kinder Morgan has been active in the CO2 sector for several decades and acquired Shell's CO2 operations in 2000, the same year it took over Devon Energy, the Scurry Area Canyon Reef Operators Committee, SACROC, unit operations in Scurry County, where CO2-based enhanced oil recovery operations had been started by Chevron in 1973. The company is also deploying various CO2 projects in the Yates Field. Rickettson estimates his company's injection of CO2 to enhance oil recovery has prevented 111 billion cubic feet in emissions. The company transports 1.3 billion cubic feet per day of sourced CO2 and recycles 1.8 billion cubic feet of CO2. Through CO2 injections, the company produces 55,000 barrels of oil per day and 121,000 barrels of natural gas liquids per day, and through its pipelines transports 140,000 barrels of oil per day. From 2000 to 2019, the company spent $7.8 billion for the entire CO2 segment, with $1.5 billion of that for sourcing and transporting CO2. Continued development of CO2 supplies is needed to satisfy not only customer demand for existing projects, but future flooding projects, he said. Supplies are available, and Rickettson said while the company's supplies currently come from naturally occurring sources at McElmo Dome, future supplies will come from industrial sources. They'll come from emissions from different industrial plants. They'll capture the emissions and we'll take them away, he said. Challenges include rising costs for wellbores, infrastructure needs, and regulations. The regulatory process, Rickettson said, requires significant planning time, with the permitting process taking from 2 to 4 years and involves local, state, and federal agencies. The good news, he told conference attendees, is that concern about the environment will drive more carbon capture projects, which is good for enhanced oil recovery. The pending changes to the 45Q tax statute will help close the gap of economic hurdles, but he said more is needed. What will really help advance carbon capture, use, and storage is developing and attracting those with CO2 EOR expertise, he said. It's a specialized industry that requires great ideas, ingenuity, and strong work ethic. Complex problem solving and diverse disciplines are needed in this business, he said.
Midland District again leads state in permits and completions. More than 50% of permits to drill oil and gas holes and new oil completions during the month of November were in the Midland District, according to the Railroad Commission of Texas. The RRC reported issuing 958 original drilling permits in November. Of those, 491 came from Midland's district, 51%. The next closest total for a district was 99 in the San Antonio and Refugio areas. The commission reported that the 958 original drilling permits was 25 more than last year. The Midland District also accounted for 50% of the 711 new oil completions in the state. The 361 new oil completions were 225 more than the next closest district, San Antonio. The San Antonio area did report more gas completions, 46, than Midland, with 34. Statewide, there were 117, according to the RRC. The commission's number of drilling permits across the state in November included 882 permits to drill new oil or gas wells, 10 to re-enter plugged well bores, and 66 for recompletions of existing well bores. The breakdown of well types for those permits is 208 for oil, 51 for gas, 621 for oil or gas, 56 for injection, 2 for service, and 20 for other. In November 2019, commission staff processed 711 permits for oil, 117 for gas, 34 for injection, and 4 other completions, compared to 794 for oil, 151 for gas, 36 for injection, and 1 for other completions in November 2018. Parkhill Smith & Cooper CEO has a mission: building community through creative, inventive, relevant environment together is company mission. The story was written by Mila McEwen. Two significant anniversaries were on J. Edwards' mind as he took over as president and chief executive officer of Parkhill Smith & Cooper. Quote, "This is our 40th year in Midland. We began in Midland in 1979, he said, sitting in the company's Midland office on Wall Street. Next year will be the company's 75th anniversary. All of that helped clarify for me our mission. Our mission is building community by creating a creative, inventive, relevant environment together. I recently met with our board and reaffirmed that this is our mission," end quote. The engineering and architecture firm provides services to meet a community's needs, from transportation to water and sewer, healthcare to education, Edwards said. Quote, "All of those things a community needs to be vibrant," end quote. Raised in O'Donnell, Edwards said he was introduced to engineering when a former resident, then Dean of Civil Engineering at New Mexico State University, returned to O'Donnell for a reunion. Quote, "I met with him and was fascinated by what he did, what engineering did," he said. After graduating from high school, he attended Wayland Baptist University in Plainview, transferring to Texas Tech his junior year, where he earned a degree in civil engineering. After graduating in 1990, he joined Parkhill Smith & Cooper. He recalled first hearing about the company living in O'Donnell, where the family lived on an unpaved road. 2 years later, that street was paved, and Parkhill Smith & Cooper was the company that oversaw the roadwork. Edwards moved to Midland in 1992 because the company was working on a master drainage project for the city of Midland, he said. Though the company is based in Lubbock, Edwards plans to remain in Midland, he said. Parkhill Smith & Cooper has 387 employees in 10 different offices throughout Texas and in Las Cruces and Albuquerque, New Mexico. He said it's nice to work in those communities and get an idea of what's happening, not just in the Permian Basin. The company also literally works all over the world, he said, listing school construction projects the company is involved in on military bases in Germany, Italy, and Japan. In its 40 years in Midland, the company has been involved in projects ranging from the new terminal at Midland International Airport to the pipeline that brings water from the T-Bar Ranch water field in Winkler County to Midland. In the 1970s, the company began working with the Scarber Brothers Corporation to develop the area that now houses the Scarber Sports Complex, the Chevron, EOG Resources, Occidental Petroleum, and Anadarko campuses, and numerous retail and housing developments. Quote, "The city invested a lot of infrastructure dollars in that area," Edwards recounted. "There was no development outside the loop and State Highway 191 when we built the sports complex. The city passed a bond and also spent funds for water and sewer lines. A lot of people said it was in the middle of nowhere. And now look at it. It has developed a larger tax base," end quote. Currently, the company is working with the city on a northeast sewer line that will follow Todd Road on the east side of Midland. Quote, "Parkhill Smith & Cooper had done a master plan for the city in 1982 and had that northeast sewer line listed as a need for the future, and here in 2019, it's underway, said Edwards. It's neat to see things we did back in the 1980s come to fruition. End quote. Other work is being done with the Midland Independent School District and Midland College, where the company is involved in the design and construction of the new student dining hall. The company, Edwards concluded, has been blessed, and his plan as its new president and CEO is to continue to oversee its growth.
Elections office is at center of community's attention by Brandy Addison. The Midland County Elections Office has been the center of the community's attention for more than a month, since the outcome of Midland ISD's $569 million bond flipped on November 12th, when final tabulations took place. The reality was the bond was failing the entire time, even on election day when I reported that it had won by 12 votes. No one knew that it was necessary to add the mail-in ballots report to the cumulative results, which were in fact not cumulative. The office became even bigger news when the bond outcome did flip from failing, when the recount tallies show that it won by 11 votes, with an 820-vote discrepancy when compared to the election day tabulations. That discrepancy later widened to 840 votes. For nearly 3 weeks, it was unknown why the discrepancy existed. However, a ballot box was discovered Thursday during a ballot count, and we learned Monday that the box contained 836 ballots from this election. They are likely the answer to the discrepancy, though that cannot be 100% confirmed. Since reporting heavily on all the twists and turns that have come with this election, you can imagine all the questions I have been asked by people wanting clarity. Trust me, I understand it's confusing. Below are the questions I've been asked most. The answers are based on what I've heard from county and election officials, Board President Rick Davis, and representatives of the two Special Purpose Action Committees, We Choose Our Future and Better Bond for Midland. Were the ballots from the new box counted? Yes and no. The 836 ballots found in this newly discovered box were tabulated by the electronic machines on November 5th, Election Day, according to elections office officials. However, because the box had not yet been discovered, when the recount took place on November 22nd, those ballots were not tallied then. This is likely the source of the 820-vote discrepancy, which widened to 840 votes on Thursday. How was this box discovered? Elections Administrator Deborah Land said the box was discovered on Thursday by an employee who was organizing a room. The employee realized the ballot box was not empty as office staff had believed. The box was just one of the two boxes that contained the overflow ballots from early voting at the elections office. These boxes were actually two metal tins and not blue boxes like the rest. Because the office has several spare tins that are empty, Land said she did not realize this tin contained any ballots, and it did not make the move to a storage facility with the other 17 ballot boxes. She did report the other overflow tin, and those ballots were tallied in the recount. Was this box marked? How did counting teams do a recount knowing a box was missing? This box did have a serial number and was sealed, but it was not reported in the chain of custody reports, as every other ballot box had been reported. Counting teams did not know the box was missing. Christine Foreman, co-chair of Pro Bond Committee We Choose Our Future, said she and others asked Land multiple times if a box was missing when learning of the 820-vote difference, and Land said no. Foreman said the counting teams double-checked every serial number against the report to make sure every box given had been accounted for. Did Midland ISD or the school board have any physical contact with any of the ballot boxes? Not to my knowledge. Elections officials said all boxes were stored in a locked facility and were removed only when representatives from both committees and the county judge were present. The mystery box was not stored in that facility, since the office was not aware of its connection to this election, so there is no reason to believe the district or board would handle a box they believed to be empty. Did the recount have to be canvassed on November 26th? Yes. Keith Ingram, Director of Elections for the Secretary of State's office, said MISD had to canvass these votes as soon as practicable, and the district should not have waited for clarity to certify the results. He said the district and both special purpose action committees have been in contact with him throughout the election process and all have done everything appropriately. Will finding these votes change the outcome of the bond? No. Once the election is certified, the outcome cannot be changed, despite anything that was revealed in the investigation process. The results, however, can be contested, and that could change the outcome. What will happen next? Will a revote take place? Representatives from Better Bond for Midland and We Choose Our Future and Board President Rick Davis said they plan to contest the election as individuals. All have agreed they do not expect a revote to take place because the number of ballots will match closely. Davis said he expects that in contesting the election, a judge will permit the tallying of these new ballots to be added to the recount. He said it appears the voting machines were correct and the bond failed, but it now must be determined in this process. Joyner additionally said the ballots from this box could not be tallied without completing an election contest, and to ensure every ballot is counted in the true result is one of the reasons he and Foreman opted to contest. Why are representatives from We Choose Our Future and Rick Davis also contesting? Special purpose action committees as a whole cannot contest an election. The statute does clarify that any individual in the county can contest an election. This includes the school board president, who will have to contest against himself, and representatives from We Choose Our Future. Christine Foreman and Dave Joyner have said their number one priority is getting the true results of the election. Joyner said, though he does want the bond to pass, he wants it to pass fairly. Davis said he also wants to find the true results, despite what the outcome may show. What happens if the bond fails during the election contest? If the bond fails, Davis said he wants to hit the restart button and start anew. MISD trustee Brian Murray agreed. Davis said he does not expect a new bond will be up for vote in May. The election would have to be called in mid-February, and he said that is too quick to ensure everything is done right. It is, however, possible for the November election. Murray and Davis have said they would want to get more support from the community. Davis said he would want to begin by reaching out to those who stated that they recognize a bond is needed but did not support this particular one. He said the biggest change he would make while creating this new bond proposal would be presenting interim reports to the community on the progress being made with the planning committee. He said he would prefer to present periodic reports to the community and get feedback rather than working on it and waiting until the end to present.